Hi everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. We've got some reports back on the World Cricket League Championship and the Intercontinental Cup, as well as in other tournaments. Some news and some previews, and to join me for those is Andrew Dixon. Hi Andrew.
Hi Russ, hi everybody.
Andrew, let's start with the World Cricket League Championship, because those matches have been completed, and Kenya travelled to Nepal, and Nepal did what you often see in the first match, which is collapsed pretty horribly for 112, and Kenya chased it down not super easily. It was a rain-reduced match. They still had a couple of overs to spare, but they won with 5 wickets to spare.
As you say, it was a rain-affected game. Obviously, I think the rain... I hope it was the rain that affected the pitch and made it difficult to bat on, and it wasn't just poor technique. I think the Nepal innings, you saw perhaps just how much they rely on Paras Kadka. Obviously, he wasn't available. I think he had some sort of stomach upset. He might even have had appendicitis. But Gyanendra Mala captain in his absence. But you saw without Kadka in, there really wasn't that much substance to that Nepal batting lineup. Obviously, they collapsed. And then, you know, Kenya sort of had a bit of a scare at the start of their innings. They were 21 for 3 at one point. And then had a Duckworth-Lewis win by 5 wickets. I think a bit of a surprise. Nepal tend to do very well at home, but not on this occasion.
Yeah, they made up for it in the second game. This time Kenya batted first and were bowled out for 155 wickets taken by Vasorka. He took 4 for 28. We probably, again, Paras Kadka wasn't there, but Jendra Mulla scored 64, and he was pretty well supported by Dipendra Iyer, who got 62. So it's typical of Nepal, a little bit all or nothing, but their bowling can definitely bowl any side out.
Yeah, you know, they've always had, you know, a decent bowling attack. It's always tends to have been the batting that's let them down in the past, and you know, it either sort of fires or it doesn't, and sometimes it might only be one person who fires. Fortunately, this time it was two who did well, and that can often be can often win Nepal a game with their bowling. If they just have two batsmen who do well, they tend to win games, and such was the case in this match.
In the other pair of World Cricket League Championship matches, Papua New Guinea went to the UAE, and we didn't have a chance to preview this series before it started, but we would have expected, I think, Papua New Guinea to win these matches, but they've been playing pretty well in the World Cricket League Championship. But UAE won pretty comfortably in the first game. They scored 292. Surprisingly, even with Shaman Anwar only making 3, there were Ramesh Shahzad made 87 and won in the end by 82 runs.
These two teams have almost done a complete 180 from where they were this time last year. You know, last year if these two teams had played each other at the same time last year, the result would have been completely the other way around. It's very disappointing for Papua New Guinea. They usually back themselves to beat a team like the UAE, and you know, something just didn't quite click for them in these games. You know, Asad Vala failed with a bat, which doesn't happen particularly often. So did Lega Siaka. So that may have played into it a bit. They have often been key batsmen for them, but they've always had other players who can step up. And you know, it's only really Tony Ura who scored 61 in that first game, and Sesi Bau as well, who looked anything, you know, like the Papua New Guinea that we used to see.
Yeah, this was part of a 3-match series, which they ended up losing 2-1. But fortunately for them, only the first two matches counted in the World Cricket League Championship, because they managed to win the second. They scored 232 in the first innings and bowled the UAE out for 206, a couple overs to spare. So not a complete disaster of a tour for them, but it has tightened up the table.
It certainly has. You look at the table now and it's becoming a little bit more of a question exactly which team might get to the top. Netherlands are currently out on top. I think had Papua New Guinea won both games, they would have been on top. So it's a little bit close at the top. It still looks like it probably is going to be between the Netherlands and Papua New Guinea. Although the ICC did send out a very confusing press release that seemed to imply that this was the last round of matches of the World Cricket League Championship, when of course there's actually two more. But we think there's two more rounds of matches. We certainly hope there are, but you know, the ICC have changed their mind about things before. You look at the you know, Scotland and Namibia haven't played yet in this round. Namibia are well out of contention, I think, now. In fact, they can't finish in the top four. But you look at Scotland, if they win both those games against Namibia, which I think you'd expect them to do, they'll climb up above Papua New Guinea. So it could end up turning out to be a pretty disastrous series for Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, it's also interesting to know that Papua New Guinea have a reasonably difficult last couple of matches against Scotland and Hong Kong. But Hong Kong themselves might actually be in a little bit of bother here, because Nepal they lost their first four games, but they've really done well over the last six games. They've won four of those matches, and if they can defeat Hong Kong in the next series, they'll have only matches against the UAE to follow, where they'll be in front of Hong Kong going into the last round.
It's becoming a very tight tournament. I think tighter than we would have perhaps have expected. And the risk of having a tournament of this type over a long period of time is that you can often get a situation where there's with a couple of rounds of matches to go, there's only really one or two teams capable of winning it. But this is proven to be quite a tight tournament, and anything could still happen. It's still wide open, perhaps with the exception of UAE and Namibia.
In the Intercontinental Cup, the first match that was played there was the one we've, I guess, been looking forward to in the absence of a final, which was the match between Afghanistan and Ireland. And Ireland had been leading the Intercontinental Cup pretty much all the games leading up to this game, but Afghanistan playing at home or in Greater Noida, and Ireland's kind of struggling a bit. This game actually was not near as close as it probably really should have been, Andrew. Afghanistan's pretty much on top from the start, declaring an 8 for 537 and then rolling over Ireland relatively comfortably.
Talk about an anticlimax. This match was hyped up as the deciding match. Everybody was hopeful it would be a close and competitive match, and Afghanistan have just run away with it. You don't expect to see teams of this standard have a margin between them of an innings and 172 runs. Asghar Stanikzai scored 145, and then Afzal Zazai, who's batting at number 8, scored 103. And when the number 8 is scoring a century, something's going wrong.
Tiredness, I think, probably really started to factor in, given that Dalad Zedrin also scored 32. I think Ireland just didn't have a lot left by the end of the innings.
And that Irish bowling attack as well. Boyd Rankin was injured and wasn't able to play in this match. And Tim Murta and Peter Chase just don't have what Boyd Rankin has. No disrespect to them. They are not rapid pace bowlers that you perhaps need in this sort of situation. When you've just got Tim Murta coming in and bowling, at 70-odd miles an hour, it's not really a threat to the batters. And you look at, Peter Chase went for 111 runs and only took one wicket. And obviously George Dockrow with the spinner took 3 for 160 in 45 overs. So they've got, bowlers are going for a lot of runs. It's not as if this was slow-paced innings. It was almost relentless from Afghanistan, and then Ireland's batsmen were just terrible, really. With a couple of notable exceptions, but especially in that second innings, where they followed on and were bowled out for 104.
Yeah, as a spinner's wicket, and I guess Ireland would have hoped for more from George Dockrell, because Afghanistan they opened with Nabi in both innings, which is always a sign that they know what's up. And but the player who just really seemed to have it all over Afghanistan, over Ireland, was Rashid Khan, again just showing his class at this level.
He's a special player. We've said it a lot on this podcast, and you look at the Afghan spinners, and they're just streets ahead of Ireland spinners. George Dockrell, eight, nine, 10 years ago, was hyped up as one of the next big things. He might be the next player to play for England. Your next Irish player to play for England, and he's just gone off the wayside. I don't think he even has a county contract anymore. Things seem to be going badly wrong for Ireland, and it's a shame. It's just when there's you know, rumours of more opportunities for them, and it's just all going by the wayside, and you sort of really start to fear what might happen in that ODI series against England next month.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how Ireland finishes out the Intercontinental Cup as well, to see how they are in relation to the next two opponents, which is the Netherlands and Scotland, because are they still ahead of those, and is it just that Afghanistan is really, really good right now, or have Ireland really slipped?
Yeah, it's perhaps a little bit of both, to be honest. Your Ireland certainly have slipped, and you know, I think they always thought that, okay, we've not been doing too well in your T20 cricket and in one-day cricket, but you know, first-class cricket, that's our thing. We're aiming to get test status, and we back ourselves to beat, you know, to beat any other associate in first-class cricket, and here it's just gone badly wrong.
Afghanistan on top of the table now, 81 points versus Ireland's 80, so it's certainly not a foregone conclusion that the who will win, but they're certainly the box sit with matches against Hong Kong and the UAE to come.
Yeah, you'd certainly back, you know, Afghanistan to beat both those teams. You know, and you wouldn't necessarily expect those games to be rained off depending on where they're being played. Whereas when you look at Ireland playing the Netherlands and Scotland, I think, you know, I think one of those games might be on neutral territory, but certainly, you know, the other, you might expect some, you know, some rain in that game, which could just put pay to Ireland's hopes there. So yeah, Ireland have to play very well from here on in to finish top, you know, depending on what happens with structural reforms to who might or might not get to play Test cricket in a couple of years.
In another match that's ongoing, Papua New Guinea are playing against the UAE, and again we've seen the resurgence of the UAE in this game to date. Papua New Guinea making 194 in the first innings, but quite a lot of players getting to start and none of them going on and making decent scores, which is in contrast to the UAE where two players made hundreds, Mohammad Usman and Saqlan Haider, and they declared it 441 with plenty of time, it looks like, to bowl Papua New Guinea out.
Yeah, this again, I think we can pretty safely say that UAE are going to win this game. Mohammad Usman and Saqlan Haider have both batted very well in there. First innings. I think UAE haven't actually won a first class game for 4 years, so this will be a big moment for them. Asad Valla again failed with the bat. He only scored 17. You know, he'd been averaging 93 in first class cricket before this game. You know, that's no longer going to be the case. And it just seems like the 2017 is almost the opposite of 2016, and you know, it's just the case again here with the Papua New Guinea match.
Yeah, Papua New Guinea are a bit of an interesting spot too. They don't seem to have got enough star players to really press their claims as being one of the best associate sides. They look like they're going to remain kind of middle of the pack, the top teams.
Yeah, I said it in my review of their 2016 for Wisden. They've sort of flown under the radar in recent years, but they are. You know, it is a country where cricket is seen as a mainstream sport. You know, with the exception of Geraint Jones a couple of years ago, you don't see the expats or the immigrant communities playing for Papua New Guinea anymore. And so it's a bit of a shame that they can sometimes be victims of the of perhaps ICC. Going after the money or the romance and of certain other teams, and with a bit of effort, you could probably get Papua New Guinea into a very good side. You know, there is some of that going on. There's some involvement from Cricket Australia, which will be very welcome. But Papua New Guinea, I think, has a real chance. You've got a culture that is familiar with cricket. You could make Papua New Guinea into a big team, but they just seem to be falling by the wayside at the moment.
In other tournaments, there was interesting tournament played amongst the emerging nations, or rather the under-23 sides of the Test Nations and the Asian Cricket Council and some of the best Asian associates. It was some okay performances by Malaysia and Nepal against those sides, a little bit disappointing from Hong Kong And Afghanistan again crashed the party of the Test Nations by beating India to make the semi-finals.
Afghanistan, as you say, sort of spoiled the party with that win over India, but then unfortunately lost to Pakistan, chasing what they probably should have chased, which they played Pakistan under 23, scored 267 for 5, and then Afghanistan were bored out for 144, which is a little bit of the, you know, that old Afghanistan emerging again. That sends to crop up, but to get to the semi-finals, you're ahead of and ahead of India as well, you know, which will annoy some people, annoy the right sort of people, I think we could say. It's fantastic, and it's good to see that they continue, even with an emerging team, they continue to do very well. You know, it just shows that, I think, that strength in depth is there for Afghanistan that perhaps isn't there for Ireland.
Yeah, to have their B-side, which is not that dissimilar in some ways to an under-23 side, they have a few players who've been around for a long time who are well-known playing in that side as well, though. To match it with those under-23 test sides who are, in general, by under-23s, the players who have made their name in first-class cricket and maybe hoping for to get into the test side at some future point. So it's not a low standard of cricket, and they were showing that their second 11 is up and almost level with the sides coming through the Test Nations.
Yeah, and as I said, yeah, I think you could probably put a couple of those, your second 11 players, you know, straight into the Afghanistan side. That's been playing Ireland recently, and I think, in fact, I think some of them did play. But certainly you would, most of those players could easily move into the, you know, the Afghanistan full side, really. You'd think that a lot of the, you know, the Ireland A side, I think they call themselves the Ireland Wolves now. I think some of those players are perhaps a little bit further away from the full Ireland side at the moment.
Moving on to news, Andrew, the Hong Kong Blitz was played. We did a bit of a preview of some of the interesting expansion that was going on before the tournament, and it really seems to have paid off in terms of the interest that was generated. It reported as 11.8 million views of the streaming over the course of the 4 or 5 days the event ran.
Which is just phenomenal. You know, I think they were hoping for maybe 2 million, and to get your 11 over 11 million is just fantastic, and I think they're hoping next year to perhaps get a proper TV deal. Although the stream was very good, some very knowledgeable commentators on there who knew the stuff, and and the cricket, it was a small ground, and the scores were very high. The quality of the cricket was in general good from what I saw. Obviously, once you move out of the, you know, the overseas players and the top Hong Kong players, the quality does drop off a little bit. But there were certainly some players who contributed who weren't amongst those top Hong Kong players. That was good to see as well. I'm sure they'll have gained so much from being able to play with those big name overseas players.
Yeah, those opportunities to train and learn from them are more valuable than probably anything else from the Hong Kong development perspective. In terms of the views, it'd be good to have a number of hours watched number, and in general, at least in a TV deal, you can get normally $1 for every viewer that watches for 1 hour. So that, in figurative terms, if it was, you know, 1 million viewing hours or something, that's a reasonable tournament to put it out to market, which would certainly benefit Hong Kong cricket.
If they can sell the TV rights for this, so you're around the world, it's going to be a big financial boost to them.
It's also worth noting that there was apparently 146,000 people watching online in Hong Kong itself, as well as having a couple of thousand people at the ground each day. So again, you're seeing a tournament within Hong Kong that's getting a lot of local interest as well. And we've talked a lot about T20 tournaments and local tournaments that kind of come and go, and they try and push think that they can get the money from a market. It's particularly the case in the US. This one seems like it has more legs than any of those that we've seen that are really just a marketing brochure and nothing behind it.
Yeah, it certainly does. This isn't your old retired players trying to get your one last paycheck, as we perhaps see with some of the US attempts to promote 2020 cricket that we've had in the past. This is the real deal, and I think it's just going to get bigger and better. There's a lot of eminently qualified people running this tournament. This isn't the sort of fly by night operation. They don't have a Pizza Hut owner trying to run a tournament. It's a proper cricket tournament. It's a proper league, and that's what they've done it so well to integrate the big name overseas stars and the local players, which isn't perhaps something that has necessarily been done in the US with the attempts there. We're just going to go get all the big names, and that'll do the job, and that probably won't do the job. You need the local players are going to bring local interest, and I think that's what happened here, and it's a success all round.
Speaking of the US, there's news from USACA. It's, as usual, a complex mess of news. I think we mentioned in the last podcast that the ICC had approved the constitution and required the USACA to endorse it by April the 1st. USACA is their way, said that they would have a meeting on April the 8th, and then said that they would not be putting forward the constitution that the ICC has approved, but a very slightly different one that just happens to have certain clauses that benefit the existing board members. The ICC was quite forward in their response by saying that they didn't approve the USACA had changed the constitution, and that they would take this into consideration at the board meeting, whether they were going to reinstate them or not. So the ICC has not played its cards and whether it will accept it, but the USACA has endorsed their own constitution.
Oh, yes. what more can we say? I think it's probably worth reading out the tweets that USACA put out overnight. So the entire membership of USACA has unanimously rejected ICC's proposed constitutional changes. Hashtag USACA AGM, hashtag Make American Cricket Great Again. And then overwhelming majority of USACA's membership voted in favour of proposed constitutional changes. Hashtag USACA AGM, hashtag Make American Cricket Great Again. And then USACA's proposed constitutional changes passed with minor edits, which has 95% plus of the ICC's proposal. And then the same hashtags. It does have 95% plus of the ICC's proposal. The problem is the other 5%, which is probably the main thing that ICC wanted changing. This has to be the end for USACA, doesn't it? But how many times have we said that in the past?
Well, it's a direct challenge to the ICC. The ICC put out a press release before this AGM on the 19th of March that said, as I said before, that they will consider what happens at the AGM. But their stance is pretty much do as we say or we'll get rid of you. And now the USACA said, well, do it then, because we're not going to do as you say. And in their other press releases were very critical of the ICC and their attempts by the ICC to impose the restrictions that they didn't like. So can the ICC not expel USACA and still be considered credible in terms of the threats that they put forward?
The USACA have put out a press release as well about a week ago now, which say, I'm just going to read one paragraph here. Remember, the ICC spent a year and a half investigating USACA and found nothing wrong. No corruption, no self-dealing, nothing untoward. Still, the ICC will not agree that a member of the US cricket community who may or may not have had anything to do with USACA in the past become chairperson of USACA after next year's election and unite the entire membership to move forward under the new constitution. It makes no sense. It evidences complete distrust for the entire USA cricket community. And then, in all capitals, and it is patently anti-democratic. Yusaka are, if they are going down, they are going down, you know, in flames. They go on to say, Yusaka believes the ICC's continued attempt to control US cricket violates US law. Yusaka believes it violates the ICC's constitution. You know, Yusaka vigorously objects to the ICC's recent press release. This isn't going to end well for Yusaka. They are not making themselves look in any way a credible governing body. You know, they've had the opportunity to try and work with the ICC so many times, and they have continually failed to do so. This has to be the end. And if the ICC now do not expel Yusaka, it makes the ICC look stupid.
We will have to wait and see what happens, Andrew. It's certainly going to be an interesting ICC meeting in April. It would be great to be a fly on the wall for it. I'm sure Yusaka still have a few allies within the ICC, not least the West Indies have always supported in the past. So they've been given enough rope to hang themselves, and it seems like the ICC has pulled away the trapdoor and let them fall if they want.
Yeah, I hope that you know, any legal threats of Yusaka are just empty threats, given some of the legal minds who work with Yusaka. They probably are empty legal threats. Because, you know, the last thing US cricket need is a battle through the courts.
Speaking of the ICC, they've got their own issues to deal with for the next couple of months. There was a, as we know, the plans to put forward the Test Championship and other reforms, as well as constitutional reforms, which were probably even more important, seem to have been stymied a little bit by the BCCI saying that they won't support the Test Championship and won't support the removal of any full members, and attempting to get allies to that effect. It may just be about the money for the BCCI, and if they get the money, they might cave. But one of the apparent fallouts was that the chairman, Menhar, retired, apparently for personal reasons, but just coincidentally the day after he met with the BCCI, and then reversed his decision a few days later at the request of all the ICC board members to stay on until the AGM in June. So there's a lot of turmoil in the ICC right now.
Just a bit, but you know, it's just ever was the case. It's interesting watching from afar just what's going on. And you know, we had our say on the proposed reforms on the last episode, but yeah, I think, as you say, I think for the BCCI, it is going to come down to money. If they get the money they want, they may cave. But I think whether they enjoy the power as well, if perhaps as much as if not more than the money, would be the key. You know, I think they like to have the ability to how can I put this as diplomatic as possible? The ability to gain influence by offering tours, and if the, you know, there's a formalised structure to international cricket where teams have to play other teams at certain times, then that ability goes away, or is certainly lessened. And that, I think that is perhaps what the BCCI fear more than the loss of money.
I'm inclined to agree. It will be interesting. I don't think the BCCI has a very firm position at the moment, not least because they have their own turmoil, and they think they're being taken advantage of during that turmoil, which has made them resentful as well. So,
which is probably right, but
it almost certainly is right, but it raises some issues because we don't know exactly what the BCCI will come to the table with, because they're still working it out themselves, and therefore it will be a difficult negotiation to have. Certainly having Menhar reverse his retirement was very important, because he's been pushing for these reforms himself, and if he was gone, it would be very difficult to see them going forward.
Menhar, you know, staying in is key for any reforms to happen. I think he's been backing them profusely, and hopefully they will go through in some form. You know, whatever comes out of it, it's probably going to be better than what we've got now. I think, as we said before, it's still a long way from being perfect.
Moving on to previews, Andrew. There's three qualifying tournaments coming up. The one has just started. It's the World Cricket League Africa qualifier for World Cricket League Division 5. There's a few teams that have got a bit of World Cricket League experience in this tournament. Tanzania and Nigeria were quite high up until recently. Botswana has been around for a while, and Ghana. They're joined by Sierra Leone and Zambia, who at least on the first day struggled a bit. Sierra Leone was bowled out for 66 against Ghana, and Zambia for 54 against Botswana. Tanzania, surprisingly, though, I think it's maybe the most interesting result the first day, was defeated Nigeria 231-83.
Yeah, I think Tanzania and Nigeria both came down from Division 5 in Jersey last year, so you would have expected them to be the favourites to go back up. And then Nigeria, obviously, got bowled out for 83 on that opening day. And then I think even more surprisingly, got bowled out for 51 by Ghana yesterday. This is a huge shock. And then Tanzania have lost to Botswana as well. So it's looking like anything could happen in this tournament. Currently, Botswana and Ghana are the only teams to have won both their opening games. And it could be that one of them ends up being promoted. Before this tournament, I would have predicted that it was going to be Nigeria or Tanzania all the way, and it certainly isn't looking like that.
Yeah, Nigeria have had a couple of strange tournaments of late. They really should be the strongest team in Africa amongst the associates once you get past Kenya and Uganda, because they've got the population, and it seemed like they had the administration that was pushing for the development of cricket there, but struggling terribly in this tournament to date. And as you say, it looks like it's going to be really interesting last three match days to decide who will go through.
It does. And I think that's what we want from these tournaments. We want them to be competitive. We don't want them to be easily predictable. I think that's what we want. I think it shows that things are changing, and teams are moving up and down, which is precisely what perhaps at the top teams don't want to happen.
Yeah, also coming up is the World Cricket League qualifier for Asia, which will include a pretty wide mix of teams by the looks of it. China, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Thailand, Bhutan, as well as Bahrain. China in the past have not been a particularly strong side, and we've seen some evidence recently that Saudi Arabia are pretty good, and I would think it would probably come down between them and Kuwait who will go through. But we might see some pretty uneven matches in this tournament as well.
Potentially as well. I think there's a bit of controversy around this tournament around the absence of the Maldives, who have beaten, I think, about half of these teams recently, and were ranked higher than a fair few of them as well. Obviously, Maldives are an affiliate, but as are some of the others, and we think we spoke in the last episode about the potential of some of the affiliates falling by the wayside. And I think China's inclusion ahead of the Maldives is perhaps a sign of that China might be a bit more welcome within ICC circles than the Maldives. I think there's going to be some mismatches in this tournament. A little surprised they've made it a 17 tournament. Perhaps China, it was going to be a 16 tournament, then China have been shoehorned in. Saudi Arabia, they have beaten some teams recently, but a lot often depends on, they have often had visa trouble, which has meant they've not always been able to field their strongest side in some tournaments, even in some Asian regional tournaments. So a lot will depend on what players they are able to get into Thailand. Whether they can win. Kuwait, I think you would back to do well as well. They've been up in the World Cricket League before in the past, even hosted World Cricket League tournaments. And Thailand playing on home territory, you can never completely rule out the home side.
Shortly after that, Andrew, there'll be a women's qualifier for the World T20 Championship in East Asia Pacific. It'll be held in Sano, Japan again. This time, just the four sides, Japan, Samoa, Papua New Guinea and Vanuatu. And based on recent results in this, you'd expect Papua New Guinea to win. They've had a very long standing rivalry with Japan, but recently, certainly the last tournament they played, it was a much stronger Papua New Guinea side that played.
Yeah, obviously there was the 50-over World Cup qualifier in the region last year, which Papua New Guinea won every match and beat Japan twice in that tournament. So I think you'd back Papua New Guinea, but in the shorter format, things might get a little bit closer, and Japan could surprise people, and Samoa or Vanuatu could surprise people as well. The teams play each other twice, which tends to rule out any huge surprises. I think when you've got those four teams and everybody plays each other twice, you tend to have the best team win in those situations. I think that will be the case here.
And that will be that for the month of April. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Russ, as always.